Hello, and welcome to a special episode of the Agnostic Salvation Hour. This is one of your hosts, Marshall.
And this is the co-host, Mike.
And the reason we're here today is I did something recently that I do regularly. Actually, it wasn't that recently. Listened to a Chariots of Iron podcast, and I'm a big fan of those guys. And a couple episodes ago, and they, by the way, they've been releasing episodes very infrequently, kind of like us, but I think even more infrequently than us.
That's possible?
Yeah, it is possible, believe it or not. They've gone huge stretches of time. Maybe, I don't know. We're close. But anyway, not too long ago, two, three episodes back, they did an episode, or maybe it was just one episode back, where they discussed the common objections to Christianity from skeptics by an apologist named Steve Hayes, whom I think you're more familiar with than I am.
Yeah, Steve, if anyone's interested, you can find Steve's rants over at Triablog. That's TRIABLOGUE, triablog.blogspot.com, and is Marshall and I were discussing before we went on the air. I mean, there's no doubt about it. They go after skeptics and unbelievers plenty, but I think they go after their fellow Christians even more than skeptics. I mean, these guys, you get the impression that even many of their fellow Christians are damned.
Well, and you know what I don't understand? As we were talking earlier, Steve Hayes is a Calvinist.
Definitely.
He believes in predetermination. He believes that either you're elect or not, and you can't do anything to alter that. So we're all going to hell except for those tiny percentage of us who God personally selected to go to heaven.
The elect.
The elect, as they're referred to. And I don't understand the concept of advocating that faith. I mean, what's the point of it? You used to be a Protestant, and you said you were briefly contemplating becoming a Calvinist. I do not understand Calvinist apologetics. I don't understand the purpose, since you can't convert a person from non-elect to elect, since that decision's made before we're even born. What is the purpose of what Steve Hayes is doing here, in your opinion?
Right. Well, no, that's definitely a legitimate question and a legitimate objection to the theological system of Calvinism. As you correctly pointed out, I was an evangelical fundamentalist Christian for over a decade, and I flirted with Calvinism, even to the point where for a while I was attending Calvinist churches, or churches that taught and promoted Reformed theology. And you're right. I mean, from a Christian standpoint, you got to wonder, well, if you just have the elect and the non-elect, what's the point of doing evangelism, since those are going to get saved, they're going to get saved anyway, and those who are going to be lost would be lost anyway. But they rationalize evangelism as they look at it as if God has chosen who he's going to save, but he's called us to bring the message so he could use us as his instruments to bring his elect into the fold. And, I mean, it's an awfully convenient explanation. And Calvinists, they do have that reputation. I mean, they'll say otherwise, but they do have that reputation of not being very good in evangelism, you know, because of, you know, their fatalistic approach to the salvation of the lost.
Well, let me see if I understand what you said correctly. Are you saying that a person who is elect,
mm-hmm.
and that means chosen by God to be saved, can a person who's elect go to hell if they're not fortunate enough to have the gospel preached to them?
Well, no. If they're elect, they will eventually have the gospel preached to them in their lifetime, and they will go to heaven. I mean, if they're the way they look at it, you could be a part of an Indian tribe in South America and never heard the gospel, but if you're truly the elect, you know, you'll run into a missionary somewhere, some way. You'll hear the gospel and you'll eventually believe it and repent and you'll be among the saved.
So it's just basically a bizarre technicality that completely arbitrary that you're elect, you're going to heaven, but as part of a technicality, somebody still has to introduce you to the gospel.
Yes. I mean, I would say so. I mean,
it's just bizarre.
It is.
I don't know how familiar our listeners are with it, but I mean, it's a concept that really makes the God of the Bible, who comes off as pretty much a monster anyway, but that's
he's a
much
dick
monster,
anyway,
a total dick, the definition of dick. I mean, the majority of us were created to eternally bake in the fires of a hell,
right?
And there's nothing we can do to alter that. And well, anyway, he does bring it up occasionally, but it's not this website. These questions aren't totally focused. His answers aren't totally focused on Calvinism. But I did get from reading this that he probably was a Calvinist of some variety.
Oh, he did.
Which, as a former Catholic, Catholics are pretty much the anti-Calvinists, or Calvinists are the anti-Calvinists.
Oh yeah, I mean, I ran. Even though I never fully 100% embraced Calvinism as a fundamentalist Christian, I ran in Calvinistic circles, and enemy number one among most Calvinists is the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, they regard it almost seems as if they regard the Catholic Church as worse than American atheists. I mean,
well, they probably do, because I mean, they think that they're instruments of Satan,
right?
And that the Catholics. Well, the Catholics don't share this common Protestant notion of salvation by faith alone.
Right.
Catholics acknowledge, are more focused on the contents of the Gospels as opposed to the contents of the Pauline letters.
Sure.
I mean, we read them. I'm not a Catholic anymore by any stretch of the imagination, obviously, and I hate the church. But, you know, while I was there, I noticed that, you know, we read the letters of Paul, but it was certainly not the focus of the theology of the church. The theology was basically, you know, you earn your way into heaven. God, Jesus, in his sacrifice, opened the door to heaven. You still have to earn your way to get through that door. Right. And now it's all a bunch of hooey, but yeah. So we're going to be answering these questions from a guy who starts from the opposite end of where I started from as a Christian. But, and again, if you out there in internet land want to follow along, the questions can be found on Common Objections to Christianity from Skeptics by Steve Hayes. Just Google that, and I'm sure it will be the top thing on there. And we're not going to take the time to answer all the questions, or respond to all of his responses, because there's just not enough time, and some of them are kind of lame.
Right.
But let's get started. Question number one. Why does the Bible condone genocide? He provides a number of responses to that question. And it's a common question. It's a legitimate question.
A lot of convenient excuses, I should say, cover up the obvious that
yes,
the God of the Bible ordains and blesses genocide
routinely in the Bible. But he starts off by saying there was no Old Testament command to eradicate Canaanites in toto. But that's actually false. Let me read to you Deuteronomy 20, verses 16 through 18. However, in the cities of the nations the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, do not leave anything alive that breathes. Completely destroy them, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. I've never heard of the Hivites before. As the Lord your God has commanded you, otherwise they will teach you to follow all the detestable things they do in worshiping their gods, and you will sin against the Lord your God. That seems to be a pretty specific order to kill all the Canaanites, along with other other races.
Right. I don't think you can get around that.
Yeah, and here, the thing is the question doesn't say, wasn't limited to just the Canaanites, but I think they're all varieties of what are now considered Canaanites. Mm-hmm. But yeah, what he said was blatantly false. There's really nothing else to go on about that. That's an absolute, by any stretch of the definition, that's a call to genocide.
Right.
You know?
Yes. You know, as we read this, and this doesn't directly refute Mr. Hayes's statements, but I'm just glad that scholarship over the years has revealed that it's very questionable that these tales, that these, scholarship has revealed over the years that it's very questionable that these recorded events of genocide even took place. Mm-hmm. There's a great chance that this is made up history or exaggerated history for nationalistic purposes of Israel. So we can at least take solace in the fact that, you know, these horrible things were not, horrible tales are not accurate historical accounts. And I don't know. I mean, you know, how can, you know, Christians, evangelical fundamentalist Christians, are quick to accuse others of being moral relativists. And, you know, I agree. There are moral absolutes. There are things that are always right. There are things that are always wrong. But if you're going to say that, I believe genocide is always wrong. But if you're going to say that everything in the Bible is holy, righteous, and true, then you have to be a moral relativist. Because you can't say that genocide is always wrong. You have to say if the God of the Bible says it's genocide is right, it's right. So It's funny. Christians, evangelical fundamentalist Christians, have to become what they accuse others of.
And exactly. Yeah.
No, I don't know if that, I'm sorry if that doesn't directly refute Mr. Hayes's statement, but it's a rant that people need to hear.
Well, and it's absolutely true. Because if you ask a evangelical apologist, is genocide wrong or is it okay? They would say, well, depends on certain, they would have to say it depends on the circumstances.
Right.
Now, I suspect that they would say it was always wrong and then just hope that you hadn't actually read the Old Testament.
That's situational ethics right there.
Yeah. But they would have to say, well, it depends on the circumstances. There are situations where genocide is okay, and there's situations where it's not okay. And there's no blanket way to say it's right or wrong. And, you know, we both disagree with that. For one reason, there's always a way. I'm not a pacifist by any stretch of the imagination.
Sure.
But I do believe that there is always a way to avoid having to completely eradicate the inhabitants of another nation.
Right.
You know, that is the first solution presented here routinely in the Old Testament. It's not, hey, try to work things out with these guys. If it doesn't work out, it sucks, but you're going to have to kill them all. There's none of that. It's like, don't even talk to these people.
Right.
Because they might introduce you to their gods. Kill them before they even get the chance to open their mouth. Then you don't have to worry about worshiping a false god.
Right, right.
And that's routinely the message that you find in the first several books, five books of the Old Testament.
Yeah.
All right. So his second objection to the question, why does the Bible condone genocide, is to say, rather, there was a command to evict Canaanites living within the borders of Israel. And he goes on to quote or cite Numbers 33, chapter 33, verse 52, which says, drive out all inhabitants of the land before you, destroy all their carved images and their cast idols, and demolish all of their high places. So he is correct. It does say that particular verse, those particular verses do not specifically require the mass slaughter of inhabitants. Of course, in order to accomplish that, you're probably going to have to kill the majority of the inhabitants. But at best, this demonstrates a contradiction found within the Bible. Because Deuteronomy 20 specifically orders the Israelites to annihilate the Canaanites living in the region, in the Holy Land, which was where all the Canaanites live. I mean, there weren't any Canaanites living outside of the Holy Land, for one thing. So, well, when you consider what the Holy Land is, it constitutes according to the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. I mean, they believed that it was a huge empire all the way from Persia to the Nile or mm-hmm. something like that.
Right.
You probably know a lot better about that than I do.
No, probably not. You know, I mean, I still have a lot to learn from, you know, Old Testament geographical topics.
Yeah. But ultimately, the fact that he was able to identify a contradiction in the Bible doesn't negate the fact that the Bible did previously say, kill them all.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just a contradiction. I've noticed in my years of reading Christian apologetical works is that they frequently do that. They think that it's almost like, you know, you'll see a debate where somebody will list one thing and they think that's canceled out if they can list a verse that right. says just the opposite.
They don't want to consider the possibility that there are glaring and obvious contradictions in their holy book, their inerrant holy book, that can't possibly be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and yeah, and that's presuppositionalism.
Right.
You start with the assumption that everything in the Bible is true and work from there.
Oh, yeah. I'm reading a book right now. I'll get back on topic in a second, but I'm reading a book on presuppositional Christian apologetics right now. It is insane. I mean, to sum it up, you know, the message is presuppose that the Bible is God's word. Why? Because it's truth. Why? Because it says it's God's truth. I mean, it is so such obvious circular reasoning, and I can't believe that there are Christians who take this seriously. But
there are
that's another discussion for another day.
There are millions. I mean, it's not just Christians. You've got the Muslims who do exactly sure. the same thing.
Sure.
With the Quran.
Right.
All right. His third objection to that question is that mass execution was a contingency plan. In case the Canaanites chose to stay and fight, which is an absolute lie. It specifically says, don't speak to them. Don't give them the opportunity not to be slaughtered. Slaughter them. But it does say that nations that live outside of the Holy Land, you only have to enslave them forever. That's all. But there is no, hey guys, we really want to live here. Could you move? I mean, that is not presented as an option anywhere.
Yeah. I'm no pacifist either, but I'm just wondering, should mass execution ever be a contingency?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's back to the moral relativism. I mean, right. The fact I can't even imagine saying that those words coming out of my mouth in defense of anything that I believed. You know, mass execution, sure, we had to go with that in the long run, in the end, but we really were trying to steer away from it. You know, no, right. I'm sorry. That's kind of the type of thing you would expect to hear from the Nazis or from the Soviets.
Right.
You know? Yes. And it's certainly not something you want to be reading in your holy scriptures.
Right. Steve Hayes, he writes that as if that's supposed to comfort us and reassure us.
Oh, that's a good point. They had no choice but to go up to them, invade their lands, and kill them all. You know, I mean, it's just such bullshit. It just, I can't, if I find myself defending a position where I'm saying that, I start to rethink my position.
Right.
You know? I don't think, no, I said, I don't really like this way this argument's going. Maybe I'm wrong on this one.
Yeah.
All right. Peaceful coexistence between the Israelites and the Canaanites wasn't possible.
Well, how does he know?
Because the Bible says it wasn't possible.
I mean, of course, and again, this is taking for the sake of argument, or this is assuming that this is historically accurate, which it's very questionable whether it is or not.
Yeah, and it's not.
But it's very questionable that it is, I should say. But it's like, I mean, how do you know? Were you there? No, the Bible says so.
Yeah, which is another instance of circular logic. But The Bible does say that. But here's the thing. Hitler said the same thing about the Jews.
Right.
You know, we can't have the Jews here living free. They're going to corrupt our people. We got to deal with this issue. I mean, when you find that your justifications are the same justifications Hitler used to slaughter people, again, I mean, you're really dealing with a very poor starting position.
Red flags.
Yeah, that's a red flag. I believe Hitler said something similar. And, you know, I do try to avoid, you know, violating Godwin's law in comparing people to Hitler. But this is a situation where you're really comparing Hitler to them. You know, did Hitler develop his tactics out of a reading of the Bible? Because that argument could be made based on his behavior.
Yeah.
And then lastly, he says, foreigners were always at liberty to convert to the true faith.
Convert or die.
Convert. Well, and actually, it doesn't even say that. Again, Deuteronomy 20, completely destroy them and list all the names as your Lord has, your Lord your God has commanded you. It doesn't say after offering them the opportunity to convert to your faith, then completely destroy them. It doesn't say that. And that reminds me of what you saw the conquistadors do in the New World in South America, is they would approach indigenous populations, read to them a order for surrender in Latin, and then when they didn't surrender, they would slaughter them or enslave them. I don't think any sane person would view that as giving them the opportunity to convert. And as if that would have been a justification. That's not even a justification. Can you imagine anyone accepting that as an excuse for Islamic atrocities?
Right.
You know, we wouldn't be butchering these Christians if they would just convert. It's that easy. I mean, that's not a defense.
Yeah. I agree. It's not a defense at all. I just out of curiosity... I wonder what Mr. Hayes' biblical justification is for his statement. I mean, does it explicitly say that foreigners were always at liberty to convert to the true faith, or is that implicit, or does it even say that at all in any way?
I think it's implicit because he doesn't list every single one of these bullet points of his. He's listed a Bible passage, and this one he did not. So he's probably just pulling it out of his ass.
That's typical of Christian apologists.
Yeah. Secondly, even if it, who cares? Again, it's not an excuse. That is not an excuse for genocide.
Right.
It's not. I'm sorry. We're adults now, and we do not require people to convert to our particular religion lest we kill them. All right. Does the Old Testament endorse slavery? His first bullet point on this one is that the Old Testament doesn't endorse slavery. I got to stop there. That's a huge lie. That is a huge lie. He even goes on to contradict himself later on, and we'll get to that. But that's a huge, huge lie. Lawmakers don't endorse everything they regulate. Rather, the law set boundaries. The law doesn't prescribe an idea. Okay, for starters... some of that's true, but, you know, the God of the Bible had no qualms telling people what they can and cannot do. Mm-hmm. You can't have gay sex. You can't eat shellfish. You can't work on the Sabbath. You can't do this. You can't do that. How about one line in the freaking Bible? You can't own slaves.
Right.
But just in case you do, these are the laws you have to follow. But keep in mind... it's a sin. Not one line in the Bible indicates slavery is sinful behavior. There's not one word or verse in the Bible suggesting that maybe God doesn't want you to own slaves.
Right. Well, and again, I don't want to give everyone the impression that I'm an expert on cultural traditions and practices of the time that the Old Testament was being written. But this is this to me seems like a perfect example that the Bible, in particular what we're focusing on right now being the Old Testament, it seems perfectly obvious that the Bible is a book, it's a product of its time and culture, as opposed to it being the timeless, inerrant, divinely inspired word of God.
Moral guide. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, this is not a moral compass that was intended to last us through the eons.
Right.
This is like, yeah, you're absolutely correct. This is just an indication of what was going on in their day and time, you know, right, and location. And that's what we're reading when we're reading the Bible. And that happens to include several endorsements of slavery, including right, the aforementioned endorsement in Deuteronomy 20, where people living outside of the Holy Land were given the luxury of being their slaves, being your slave, as opposed to being slaughtered.
Right. And, you know, a common response to this problem by Christian apologists is that, well, the slavery system back then wasn't the slavery system that we had in the American South pre-Civil War. And, you know, again, I'm not an expert on that, but I just have to wonder. I mean, so it brings up the question concerning whether slavery, so do you believe slavery then is always right or is it always wrong? I mean, if you're going to be consistent here, you have to, the Christian apologists, if they're going to be totally consistent, they have to say, well, there are times when slavery is right, if it's in a certain context. So again, you have the moral relativism, the situational ethics. And, you know, I'm not saying that moral relativism, I mean, you know what, fact of the matter is, although I do believe in moral, an objective morality, absolute morality, I acknowledge that certain morals may be relativistic. There might be, some ethics might be situational. I mean, I'm not saying that never has a place, but again, I mean, in this case, the Christian apologist has to be a moral relativist. He has to be a situational ethicist. He has to be the person that he accuses others of being.
Yeah, and fact of the matter is the Bible endorses two varieties of slavery. It endorses indentured servitude type of situation where a person voluntarily enters a contract to be another person's servant for like 7 years or something like that. And that's what they're referring to when they talk about the biblical slavery being different. But it also very clearly and in numerous locations advocates involuntary slavery, where the slave is the personal possession of the person who purchases said slave, and that slave has no say in the matter. Mm-hmm. That is made explicitly clear in a number of locations in the Bible. There are rules for purchasing slaves.
There's rules for beating slaves.
Rules for beating slaves that, you know, if you purchase a slave from a foreign merchant, he is yours for his entire life, and you may pass him on to your descendants, and his descendants are also your slaves. I mean, that's spelled out in the Bible. That is exactly the same thing that we saw in American slavery, you know, in 19th century, 18th century Western slavery. So they're either lying or they're just not familiar with the text of the Old Testament when they make that particular argument. Because I've heard it before.
Yeah.
And it drives me absolutely crazy. Okay, he goes on to say that to bring up the indentured servitude thing that we just discussed as an explanation for why slavery is included. Everyone agrees that was in there, and you know, you can even argue that it because it was a willing decision on the part of both sides that it was moral and should have been legal. Who knows? But then he goes on to say that, you know, that it was okay to enslave war captives.
Right.
Because it was more humane than executing them. As if those were the only two options you had. You'd have...
Yeah.
You know, that's... Oh, God, it just drives me crazy. As if, you know, the only... Well, we should kill them. No, I got an idea. Why don't we just enslave them? You know, or how about we just sign a peace agreement? They, you know, not every war has to involve the permanent enslavement of an entire population.
Right.
You know? We've kind of figured out a more moral alternative to that.
Yeah.
It's and again, this is and he's defending that, which right. means I would assume that he would defend it in the modern days as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh yeah. Well,
I don't see how he wouldn't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we right here we get a small glimpse of the typical simplistic fundamentalist mindset, which, you know, either or and little no compromise whatsoever. And yeah, you know, I do spend time on their website. It's a little off the subject, but not unrelated. I mean, they've been talking about politics, and I'm not here to endorse candidates or anything, but they're over at Steve's website. They're hardcore warmongers over there. I mean,
I imagine. Yeah. They probably have us nuking Iran right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Oh, yeah. They kind of remind me of the guys at Theology Online.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever been to that, but I
guess. No, I haven't.
Oh, God, I don't recommend it. It's just a bunch. It's insanity. I mean, I would go there and debate Christians, and I eventually concluded. This is like having a debate with someone who's completely insane. At some point, you realize, what's the point of this?
is that J.P. Holdings' website?
Oh, God, it might be. J.P. Holdings' nut job.
Oh, he's as far as internet apologists go, he might be worse than Hayes.
He might be. He is so stupid. I mean, this Hayes guy doesn't seem stupid.
Guess not.
He seems misguided. He seems his morals are horrific. The God he worships, the way he describes him, this God is a monster. He almost admits that at certain points.
Right.
And his response is just deal with it. But Holding's a moron.
Yeah.
But anyway. Question 3. What is this? If God truly loved people, why has he slaughtered so many of them throughout the history of the world? Hayes' response is, from a biblical standpoint, the question is not whether God loves everyone, but whether a just and holy God can love anyone, given the fact that we're sinful, evil creatures.
And this is a glimpse into the Calvinistic belief system to which Hayes and his blogging buddies adhere, because in Calvinism teaches that God does not love everyone. He only loves the elect.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so. He hates everyone else because they deserve to be hated. And I think this attitude represents a huge section of Protestant Christianity and even Catholicism. Their attitude towards humanity as a whole, that we're sick and vile creatures deserving to be tortured eternally. And this is an appalling assumption, and it's just one that I just reject.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can... it's a subjective position one way or the other. Are we sinful, evil creatures? Well, in your opinion, maybe. In my opinion, we're not. But I don't consider myself an evil creature, go ahead.
No, I would say, wouldn't a more realistic and rational response be that as human beings, we're capable of wonderful good, and at the same time, we're capable of the most horrible of evils? I mean, I'd say that's a more... a rational way of looking at it. I think the question is, are you going to yield more to the side that's capable of good or the side that's capable of evil. But I don't know. It's awfully simplistic. And not that I'm Mr. Optimist, but even that kind of thinking is way too pessimistic for me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I certainly agree that that we as a species we're imperfect and we have our problems, but just to basically to say that we deserve all variety of torture because we're bad, that's just, I mean, what is this God? Is he like a 6-year-old? I mean, this is just the most childish way to look at existence that I've ever seen. And it's shared by a large number of Protestants.
Right. It's awfully petty for sure.
Yeah. Well, and just this notion that God could create us knowing with full awareness that he's going to end up torturing almost all of us eternally.
Right. Well, they also believe, you know, they believe the story of Adam and Eve is literal history. And as Calvinists, they believe that God knew that Adam and Eve were going to fall into sin. And so, you know, God in Calvinism, God is sovereign over everything. He controls everything. So he directed them to do what they did. So whose fault is it then? Is it our fault that we're sinful, or is it God's fault? I mean, you're looking at it, it'd have to be God who's at fault.
Well, and who's the truly evil one? Is it the evil creatures that God created to be evil, or is it the guy who created them who's the evil one? I mean, if I were to design a robot and then program it to kill everyone in town, I don't say bad robot. I would accept the responsibility for those deaths on my own. I just don't understand how anyone can accept this line of thinking, or be satisfied with this type of theology, and just not find how how lacking in morality. This is a very immoral view of reality, in my opinion.
Yeah. I once was talking with a Christian friend of mine. Actually, he's no longer my friend. He flat out told me he just couldn't talk to me anymore. And I was talking to him about these things, these evil things you see in the Old Testament, and, you know, the genocide. So I don't, you know, but in stuff like this, what we're reading now, you know, I remember saying that the God of the Bible violates his own moral standards from time to time. And he told me, you're being pretty judgmental of God. So I'm just supposed to be satisfied with this idea that we can't violate God's moral standards, but God can violate God's moral standards, and that's okay.
And then he can judge us for violating the standards that he violates routinely.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and obviously, what this points to is that he doesn't exist in the first place.
This Judeo-Christian God. I'm an atheist when it comes to that.
this guy is a creation of a kind of a barbaric culture. And I'm not saying that Jews are barbaric, but they were at the time. I mean, the people who crafted the Old Testament were not upstanding individuals. I'm just going to say that.
No, I was listening to one of my, just prior to this, I was listening to one of my favorite Metallica songs. I was exercising, Creeping Death, which is based on the Exodus story. And, you know, I'm thankful, again, there's not a shred of evidence for the Exodus story ever taking place. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's most likely mythology. But, you know, if you read that, God is a baby killer, the way he had the firstborn Egyptians killed. I mean, that right there is despicably evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, well, absolutely. Actually, on numerous occasions, God of the Bible endorsed or actually participated in infanticide.
Right.
Which has for a while now made me really think it's odd how staunchly opposed Christians were to abortion. And I'm not speaking pro or for abortion like this, but how can you say something's immoral when you worship a God who participated in it routinely, according to your scriptures?
Right.
I don't know. These are the type of questions that led me not to be a Christian anymore. And honestly should lead everyone not to be a Christian anymore. Just because there are no good answers to them.
In a perfect world, it would lead everyone to not be a Christian.
Yeah.
People need their delusions. I was just thinking about that today. I mean, there are brilliant people who believe this stuff. Extremely smart people, and smart people who are much smarter than me. But to have such infantile beliefs as the Bible's is inerrant, that this can be these kind of activities can be morally permissible. It must be because it gives people validation. I mean, there's probably many reasons, but it is what it is.
Yeah, and I'll be honest with you, I was a former Christian myself, but I still don't understand what held me in once I started thinking about it. And actually, as I started to view my faith, taking theology classes and things like that, that's really what led me out of Christianity is knowing what I was supposed to believe, rather than just assuming, well, they've done all the thinking for me, I'll just trust what they say and go from there. But when I was expected to actually know it, that's when my skepticism kicked in. And I honestly think that there are some people who just don't have a shred of skepticism, that just aren't prone to thinking skeptically.
Right.
I don't know why. I'm skeptical about everything, and as we said in a past episode, there's a difference between skepticism and cynicism. Mm-hmm. That skepticism can lead to positive beliefs about things.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a system that you. It's just a mythology that you undergo to come to your beliefs.
Yeah.
But anyway, all right.
Just one last thing about skepticism, then move on. I got in a debate with a Christian apologist who asked me if I'm skeptical of everything and trying to imply that you can't be skeptical of everything. And I agree. You know, all skepticism is just being skeptical of implausible claims until there's sufficient evidence. I mean, you know, that Christian apologist, he's skeptical of miracles recorded in the Quran. I mean, that, and so we're just skeptical of every implausible claim, whether it's in the Bible or the Quran, until there's sufficient evidence, which there isn't. But it's really not such a wild and radical concept. I just want to say that.
Well, I've always said that the best skeptics I've ever met were Christian apologists discussing other religions.
Yeah, well said. Exactly.
And it really is true that they could point out the absurdity of someone else's beliefs just, instantly.
Right.
And they're right. But they will not do the same thing with their own beliefs.
Right.
I mean, they will instantly point out the absurdity of a belief that isn't even half as absurd as the concept of the Trinity or the Holy Eucharist or things like that.
Yeah, they get pissed when you apply the same skepticism that is applied to other religions, when you take that same skepticism and apply it to the religion of Christianity.
Exactly. So, all right, we're going to skip some questions and go to question 10. How can it be just to consign people to eternal torment in hell for sins committed in a relatively brief period of time on earth? And he gets some really stupid. This is where we really see his Calvinism. This is the section where I was like, okay, this guy's clearly a Calvinist. Mm-hmm. And I think we've actually talked about some of this earlier in the show. But he says, this first bullet point is, it's not as if sinners are merely punished for discrete sins. A sinner does what a sinner is. Sins are just the expression of the sinner's underlying character. Okay, but that doesn't answer the question. That doesn't mean that they deserve to be tortured eternally. Even if you take that into, even if you just say, yeah, that's true, a sinner, we're all sinners. It's not we're all sinners, ergo eternal torture. There's a missing step there. And he doesn't even pretend to answer it, to provide it.
Right. Two things that come to mind at first. You know, obviously, I believe in good and evil. I believe, you know, good and bad, right and wrong. You know, but this whole, you know, it's Christians. They claim to be so harsh on sin and not believe it, but calling something sin, I think, kind of takes away how bad something really is. You know, if someone goes in and, you know, like what happened at Columbine High School, what was that, almost what, 13 years ago, almost 13 years ago, that's not sin. That's fucking evil. Part of my language. That's wrong. I mean, just to say that that's sin, or, I mean, it doesn't really do justice. The Holocaust wasn't sin. It was despicably and horribly evil. Mm-hmm. Okay. And, you know, this whole concept of sin, I mean, when you believe in sin, at least the Christian version of it, you know, you really, how can you not be a sinner? I mean, everyone, how can you not sin, even if you're the most blood-bought, sanctified Christian? Because according to their line of thinking, you know, look, thinking a woman's hot is the same, is equal, or, I mean, it deserves hell as much as raping a woman.
Exactly.
Does.
Yeah. Well, and, and by Steve Hayes's line of thinking, there's no distinguishing between the severity of sins either. You know, sin is just the side effect of being a sinner, whether that means that you lie or you butcher 1,000 people on your way to work. You're a sinner either way, and you deserve the same treatment in the long run. And I don't know. I mean, this really just boils down to, you know, sometimes there's just the illogic and the absurdity of a position is such that you don't really have to provide a well-thought-out argument to it.
Right.
Because it's so stupid from the get-go that if you're sucked in by this, then no argument's going to persuade you otherwise anyway.
Yeah, right. And, you know, this doctrine of hell, even from a biblical standpoint, it's not consistently taught throughout the Bible. In the Old Testament, there's very little to no mention of the New Testament concept of hell. Even in the New Testament, there is mention of the place that Christians have come to believe is there is mention of the place called hell that Christians have come to believe in. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm thinking mainly in the Gospel of Matthew, but even in the New Testament, there are verses that would seem to contradict the classic teaching of hell. So this isn't even from a biblical standpoint, this is not a doctrine that's consistently taught in the Judeo-Christian scriptures. I mean, again, I think it reveals how cultural the Bible really is, because you know, you don't see much mention of it at all, almost no mention of it in the Old Testament, except for one verse in Daniel that could somewhat be interpreted. But and then going into the New Testament, it's very plausible that they had influence from Greek ideas, Hades.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Or even
Hindu or Buddhist. Well, Buddhists didn't have a concept of hell, but the Hindus did. Mm-hmm. There's a number of pre-existing concepts of hell. I mean, there's a number of societies that believed in hell before the Christians came to it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or at least an afterlife of consciousness.
Yeah. Well, and there are, you know, there's the rich man who wants a sip of water to quench his thirst because he's surrounded in fire. And then I think Revelations mentions an eternal lake of fire that Satan is tossed into.
Right.
Which they assume is hell.
Right.
But that's almost missing the point too, though, is because even if every other verse in the Bible mentions hell, and if you've ever read any portion of the Quran, you'll know that it refers to hell constantly, and it's just ad nauseum. It's so poorly written, it's just ridiculous. But anyway, even if it that doesn't mean it actually exists, and if it does exist, we're going to assume for a second that it does exist. The fact of the matter is this God is an absolute monster.
Right.
But let's go on to some more of his bullet points here. He goes on to say that the passage of time does not make the guilty less guilty. Once you do something wrong, it will always be the case that you did something wrong.
I guess getting forgiveness from Mr. Hayes is pretty hard. That's the way he looks at people who have wronged him and have apologized. I mean, so according to this line of thinking, it almost sounds as if he's justifying, you know, retaliation against people who have wronged him, who've apologized, you know, whether even if it's like 30 years later.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because if I lie to you, then that lie never goes away. And I don't know. It is true that if I tell a lie, no matter what I do, I will have always told that lie. But again, it doesn't necessarily follow that Marshall told a lie, ergo he should be tortured eternally. Mm-hmm. Again, he's making the leap without... There's the missing premise here.
Right.
So-and-so committed to sin, ergo eternal torture. No, not really. That's not the way we view... that's not the way we humans view our concepts of morality.
Right, well, it's this very concept of hell being a place of eternal torture and torment forever and ever and ever. It's so illogical and immoral. I mean, look at our justice, the justice system of any society, whether it's humane or barbaric. I mean, there's no one in the long run, no one is punished, at least humanly speaking, no one is punished eternally. Even if you're, you know, put in a cell for the rest of your life, eventually that comes to an end because you die. You know, I think of those creepy Saw movies where the guy has those guys, people trapped. And even, I mean, eventually those people are put out of their misery. I mean, this guy's a sadist, obviously, but he's almost like Mother Teresa, although I don't know if Mother Teresa is the best example these days, but some stuff has come out about her. But I mean, this, to use biblical terms, the character in the Saw movies is a saint compared to the God of the Bible, because he at least puts people out of their misery eventually when he punishes them, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And
here's the thing, that nobody that I know denies that legitimate criminal actions should be punished. I think we all agree that there should be some sort of punishment for that to discourage it in the future. But we all agree that the punishment should be commensurate with the severity of the crime.
Right.
It should be severe enough to discourage a repeat of the crime, but not so severe that the punishment is actually a greater evil than the evil it was designed to prevent.
Right.
You know, I mean, I could, you know, they could change the law so that if you get a speeding ticket, you're executed for getting a speeding ticket. And that would probably be a pretty effective deterrent. But I think everyone with any degree of moral appreciation for morality and fairness would argue, now that's just going too far. You know, okay, write them a ticket, but we're not going to execute people because they're going 2 miles over the speed limit.
Yeah.
That's absurd. Yes, they committed a crime. Yes, there should be some sort of appropriate punishment, but underlying appropriate. It has to be an appropriate punishment. It can't be, again, like I said, a greater evil than the evil it was intended to prevent.
On a related note, the Christian Reconstructionists, they envision a American society with the Old Testament law where adulterers, homosexuals, even disobedient children, I think maybe even disobedient children, would be stoned to death.
Yeah. And did they actually say stoned?
Well, the penalty, I believe, would be death.
Via stoning?
I would have to look at the specifics, but, you know, they would advocate the death penalty for those.
Well, I mean, and if you're a person who advocates brutally murdering your child for disobedience, I mean, you're grossly immoral. you're not somebody I want living in my community. I mean, I'm scared of you. I am legitimately scared of that person. And you certainly don't represent anything that I would consider a god.
Right.
Yeah, that's just terrifying that anyone would find that a reasonable course of action, a reasonable response to picking up sticks on the Sabbath or whatever. And actually, that's a specific example from the Bible where a guy picked up sticks on the Sabbath and God advised stoning him to death.
Right.
So, yeah, this... Anyway, so we're back on hell. My favorite thing, perhaps in this entire website, is this next response to how can God torture people forever? And it's bullet point number 3, and it says... Sinners don't cease to be sinners when they go to hell. To the contrary, they become even more sinful in hell since they lose all self-restraint in hell.
How does he know this? Has he been to hell?
Yeah, how the fuck does he know this?
Yeah,
I mean, the Bible doesn't even say that.
Right. I mean, I'd be curious for his biblical justification for...
He just totally pulled that out of his ass. And secondly, okay, you're in hell. You're in a burning lake of fire. Just what opportunities to sin would there be in that scenario? Mm-hmm. You know, you go like, you know, I think I'm going to gamble while I'm here in hell. I mean, if you could actually have the opportunity to sin while you're in hell, mm-hmm. then perhaps hell really isn't that bad of a place.
Yeah.
You know?
And hell, hey, maybe it's just a big Vegas.
Yeah. Maybe I want to go there in hell. Oh, I just lost this hand of Texas Hold'em. Got people coming around and giving you drinks and I don't know, just this notion that you could even sin in hell, like the opportunity presented itself.
Maybe there, you know, it says we lose all self-restraint in hell. There better be some good brothels down there.
Yeah, there better be, because I plan on having a party when I'm in hell. If Steve Hayes is correct,
yeah,
then it might not be that bad of a time. Right. That actually reminds me of a joke I heard not too long ago. This guy goes to hell. He's really sad. Satan walks up to him and says, "Hey, buddy, what's wrong?" "Well, I'm in hell. I don't want to be here." "Oh, gosh, it's not so bad. Hey, do you like drinking?" "Yeah, I love drinking. I used to drink all the time when I was alive." "Well, that's Sunday. Sunday's drink all you want day. We just drink and drink and drink. It's a blast. If you like drinking, you're going to love Sunday." "Awesome. Okay, well, I'm looking forward to Sunday then." Says, "Hey, do you like gambling?" "Oh, God, I used to gamble all the time. I love gambling." "Well, that's Monday. That's all we do Mondays. Gamble, gamble, gamble. It's just a whole day dedicated to gambling." "Awesome. I can't wait." "Hey, do you like hardcore drugs?" "I love drugs. In fact, that's why I'm here. I died of a drug overdose." "Well, then you're going to love Tuesday. That's all we do on Tuesday is any drug you want to do, we got it." And Satan says, "Do you like anal sex?" "No. No, I'm not really a big fan of anal sex." "Oh, you're not going to like Wednesday then." I thought that was hilarious when I heard it. All right. But anyway, apparently that's where Steve Hayes got his concept of hell, is from that joke. Because this notion that we can just sin all we want in hell really kind of makes it sound like an attractive place to be.
Right.
I'm going to pass. There's a whole bunch more on that. It's all stupid on the hell. Okay. Question 11 is how can Jesus send people to hell when they've never even heard of Jesus or had the opportunity to believe in him? We already discussed that. And that's because people, the moment that sperm hits that egg, that's a human who deserves to be tortured in hell.
Right.
The second you exit your mother's womb, you deserve to be fried for eternity, according to Steve Hayes.
Yeah.
So this is a sick and twisted guy. I mean, right. That's really all there is to it.
He believes little babies. I mean, according to this, if he's consistent with, he believes that babies, he'd have to believe that babies go to hell. So, I mean, I wonder then, does he think babies should are better off being aborted, never even...
Well, no, that would just hasten their trip to hell, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a sick guy. I mean, his beliefs are really beyond... this guy's obviously a bit of an extremist.
Oh.
Probably leaning more towards the Phelps Klan than your average run-of-the-mill Christian.
Yeah.
But his beliefs are actually fairly consistent with longstanding Christian.
Well, the Bible, and I'm not saying I'm not endorsing this, but you know the Bible, you know, mostly in the Old Testament, in the I'm thinking of the Psalms, teaches that God hates the evildoer. He it says he hates. In Romans, Jacob, how I love Esau, have I hated it. You know, maybe people like Fred Phelps aren't being so unbiblical. I mean, a lot of Christians just like to say, oh, you know, that's not what the true God of love is. Well, have you read your own Bible? And again, I'm not saying that everything in the Bible is bad. I mean, there is
there's
some wisdom. I mean, I'm not, but I'm just saying, you know, let's be honest about what the Bible really says.
Yeah. Yes. And I think Steve Hayes and the Phelps are, well, no, Steve Hayes wasn't honest about it previously in the slavery discussion. But the Phelps, they are fairly honest about it, and they do basically say, yeah, he's not a nice guy.
Right.
But who else are you going to worship? And if you don't want to go to hell, you're going to get, well, but they're strict Calvinists too.
So oh, Phelps is he's a Calvinist. He's very open about his Calvinism.
Yeah, he's as tulip as you can get.
Right.
And most listeners probably don't know what that means. I can't. Tulip is a
I know it.
What is that? A totally depraved.
Tulip, TULIP. T is in. It's almost like a cheerleading chant. total depravity. T is in total depravity. U as in unconditional election. L is in limited atonement, meaning Jesus on the cross didn't die for everyone. He only died.
For the elect.
I or irresistible grace, you know, the grace of God. The true elect can't resist the grace of God. And P, perseverance of the saints, which means a true believer can never lose their salvation. And that belief leads people, you know, Calvinists or just Christians in general who don't believe true believers can't lose their salvation to, they would say of apostates like me that I was never truly a Christian in the first place. I never truly believed.
Well, you know, one thing I wondered about Calvinist and Tulipist, you know, the hardcore guys, is now we both know that Steve Hayes, for example, has sinned. Mm-hmm. So he has done something that even he would acknowledge was a sin. He may never admit to doing it to you and I, but he's done it.
Sure.
Sometime in his life, he's lied, masturbated. lusted after someone who wasn't his wife or whatever. Mm-hmm. He's done something that he's considered a sin that makes him a sinner. How in his mind does he believe that he's not going to hell?
All right. Well,
and you're more familiar with this than I. I mean, what was the justification that you normally heard?
Well, I mean, the way you justify is that your sin as part of the elect, your sins are covered by the blood of Jesus, you know.
Wow.
You are, because of Jesus' blood, you are righteous in his sight, in the sight of God.
So it doesn't matter. As long as you accept the gospel and you're elect, you're in.
Right, yeah. I mean, they would claim that, you know, true believers then don't seek to live a lifestyle of sin. Of course, you know... how do I respond to that? But I mean, quote unquote, true believers, you know, live just as much a life of sin as anyone. I mean, if you look at the way he conducts himself on his website, even his fellow brothers in the Lord, I mean, mm-hmm. how that isn't sinful, you know, or quote unquote sinful, because the whole Christian concept of sin, I find very problematic, but
yeah.
You know,
all right, let's continue. If God truly wants people to believe in him, why doesn't he simply show himself to them like he did to Paul or the apostles or whomever? He goes on to say, his first bullet point, God doesn't intend to save everyone. Okay.
Classic.
So he's an asshole, basically. Right. He could save everybody. He could want to save everybody. He just doesn't on either of those condition cases. And that tells you basically all you need to know. I mean, this guy doesn't exist. This is stupid. I mean, nobody can be this monstrously evil and be competent enough to create a universe.
Right.
I mean, this guy is the God that Steve Hayes worships is just consumed with hatred.
Right. And yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, go ahead.
No, I'm going to say to the fairness of non-Calvinist Christians, they would actually agree with us that the God of Calvinism is evil because mm-hmm. they would believe it's evil that God could save everyone, but he doesn't.
But he wants to.
Right.
But he wants everyone to find salvation. He's just not going to do it all for them.
Right. Right.
Or they still have to. They still have to accept Jesus' sacrifice.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, even just goes to show you, even Christians among Christians, they don't even worship the same God, do they?
No, they don't. I mean, and that's why. Pascal's Wager is such a failure because not only do you have to, and you're familiar with Pascal's Wager, aren't you?
Oh, of course. Yes.
You know, just to be on the safe side, you might as well worship God.
Right.
Because what does it hurt? Well, I mean, it could hurt because not only do you have to pick the right religion, that's a crapshoot right there, picking the right religion, but say you pick Christianity or Islam. Well, then you got to pick the right sect of Christianity. Because if you're a Catholic and God's a Protestant, well, you're still going to hell. In fact, there's a special hell for a Catholic, according to a lot of Protestants.
Right.
And or vice versa.
Right.
So ultimately, odds are very slim. Even if you do pick a God with the intention of doing so to avoid hell, odds are you're still going to hell, mm-hmm. according to that mindset. Mm-hmm. So, and that's one of the reasons why I don't find it an effective argument. The other reason is that it just gives too much control over to the people who would create a religion for their own purposes, which is what I think is the case with most religions. I mean, they had to start somewhere,
yeah,
for some reason.
You know, isn't in the, you know, I don't have any 100% proof for this, but isn't this whole belief of hell, it just isn't it easy to see how this could totally be used to make people afraid and keep them under control so they'll give you their money and riches and everything? I mean, it's awfully convenient.
Well, we've seen that too. I mean, certainly with tithing in the,
right.
You know, in the Christian faith, where Christians are expected to give 10% of their income. Mm-hmm. And I've routinely heard Christian radio hosts or television personalities and things like that being asked by people, you know, having letters sent to them by somebody who's unemployed, saying, listen, I don't have any income. I get a little bit of money here and there, but I just don't have any money to donate. And they say, it doesn't matter what your income is. We still need to get 10% of that.
Right.
And one person even went so far as to say that if you don't tithe, you are effectively stealing from God.
Right. And based off Malachi, verse
yeah,
Malachi.
And you're going to hell. And yeah. And that's a person talking because they need the money, because if they don't keep getting donations, their ministry is going to fold.
Right.
And his job is to make sure that you give him 10% of your income. That's his job.
Right.
To make sure that he gets 10% of your income. That'd be a great job, by the way. And he's got a great job. Whoever it is. I mean, there's a variety of these guys. Bot Radio, I've heard it on a number of occasions. I've heard Pat Robertson and 700 Club say the exact same thing. You know, it does not matter what your financial situation is. We need 10% of your income.
Right. I mean, the teaching is, you know, if you're not giving to the Lord what you should be, that might be a sign that you're not truly a Christian, that you're not truly living for the Lord. And, you know, ultimately the consequences of not being a Christian are hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
is hell. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. So, anyway, there's a bunch more questions. We've gone on for about an hour now, actually a little over that. And, you know, as we've gone into this, it's just, this guy's a moron. He's not a moron. I'm going to take that back. He is not a moron. But he's not representative of the majority of Christians. And I don't think he's convincing anyone. I mean, these are some pretty wild answers.
Yeah. I mean, you say he's not representative of the majority of Christians. You're right. He has some wild answers that even many Christians would find repugnant, but let's not sugarcoat it. I mean, the majority of Christendom believes pretty vile doctrines, such as the existence of a place of eternal torment called hell, and that genocide. I mean, at least a large portion of evangelical fundamentalist Christianity, they would believe that there was a time and a place where genocide and slavery could be righteous.
It's just barbaric. All right, let's tackle one more question, one that I was particularly interested in. Question 15, for those of you following along at home. Why do Christians refuse to accept the historical and archaeological evidence that much of the Bible was plagiarized from ancient Near East sources? His first bullet point is stupid. That's a vague, sweeping allegation. Why I think it's true is what he says.
is that supposed to be a refutation of the statement?
Yeah, that's one of them. And the fact of the matter is there are a lot of reasons to think it's true. There are countless volumes of archaeological studies and surveys and findings that provide him an answer to that question. He's probably familiar with those things. He's just pretending that they don't exist by that answer. His second response to that question is this objection tends to be duplicitous. On the one hand, we don't have any corroborative evidence for reported events in the scriptures. The unbeliever then says that this just goes to show that the Bible writers made things up whole cloth. No. There's actually a reason why we assume that certain events, as described in the Bible, didn't happen and were made up by one person or the other.
Like the as we were talking about earlier, the Exodus.
For
which there's not a shred of evidence.
Not a shred of evidence, and you know the rule is normally that an absence of evidence is not an evidence of an absence, but that's not always the situation. And if you take the Exodus, like you pointed out, as described by the Bible, you have a population of approximately 2 million per the Bible individuals traveling for 40 years. From Egypt to Jerusalem. They don't leave a trace of evidence. This isn't reported by any historical source anywhere. Or you take the plagues that led up to the Exodus. In those plagues, Egypt, the entire nation of Egypt, had its entire food supply destroyed by various plagues, had all the water in the nation and in the Nile turned to blood, had all of the firstborn killed, had its entire military destroyed.
You're making me want to jam out to Metallica.
Yeah, and had all and was looted of all its gold by the departing Israelites. They lost everything. In reality, if that had happened, Egypt would have ceased to exist as a nation. This would have been a mass extinction event. The history books would talk about a nation formerly known as Egypt that mysteriously went extinct. But there's no mention, there's no interruption in Egypt history. Egyptian history. There's no mention of the time where the entire military was destroyed in a gigantic tidal wave. None of that is reported anywhere except for the book of Exodus in the Bible. That can be viewed as evidence of the fact that it didn't happen. Because if it had happened, there would be tons of evidence supporting it. So yeah, and then you also have Noah's flood,
right?
Which clearly didn't happen.
As a worldwide flood, it's science. That's scientifically impossible. But well, wasn't there something recorded? Go ahead. My thought will come to me.
Well, I think you were going to say something about the Epic of Gilgamesh. Is that where you're going?
Yeah, I mean, isn't there evidence that the flood story, you know, I'm not saying that this actually happened in history. I mean, it's impossible, but this view of a massive flood is not original to the Bible.
No, it's not. And that's, yeah. Noah's flood story was borrowed almost verbatim, not verbatim, but every detail of it can be found in a pre-existing Babylonian text called the Epic of Gilgamesh, where there was a man was warned of an upcoming flood. He built a boat, loaded it up with animals. The flood came, killed everyone, and it's identical to the Noah story. It's a little more coherent because the Noah story is so contradictory and stupid. But that's where they got it from. And it's almost certainly predates the Noah story. I mean, there's very little reason to suspect that it doesn't. But this is the type. But Steve Hayes is basically saying that we're just assuming that these events didn't happen because they're not. They're not identified in the history books, and he's just flat out wrong. I mean, there's another example of where. Old Testament basically blatantly stole an event or a story from pre-existing pagan sources.
Right.
It's with the birth of Moses, where almost verbatim, the same story is told of Sargon, an emperor of the Akkadian Empire, where he was placed in a basket and then placed in a river and then later rescued and became the emperor of his nation.
So, speaking of Moses, there's not a shred of evidence that there was a historical Moses.
Yeah, and I think that the Old Testament even alludes to that fact by coming up with a story why he doesn't have a tomb or any statues erected to his existence or anything like that.
It's always funny that it's funny to realize that, you know, I would say probably Orthodox Jews and evangelical fundamentalist Christians would say that Moses, if there was a historical Moses, wrote the first five books of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, Deuteronomy is that fifth book, and that records Moses' death.
I know. Yes. And yeah. And where he was buried. And, well, yeah, and the whole thing where Moses was refused entry into the Holy Land because he hit a rock with a stick twice instead of once. That hit the entire mission that his life was dedicated to, he was denied because he tapped a rock twice. I mean, that's just stupid.
He disobeyed God's commands.
Yeah, and yeah. So anyway, we'll conclude there. Basically, what we're seeing here in Steve Hayes, though, is a guy who really does not want to honestly confront the issues. He's just, to the best of his ability, dismissing the objections to Christianity without seriously taking it on, hoping that his target audience isn't going to go beyond his website.
Right.
Because if they do, they're going to find out his answers are kind of stupid. In fact, I don't know how anyone reads some of his answers and just not immediately say, wow, wow, how does anyone believe this shit?
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, if I were still a Christian and I read his website, I would be horrified.
Yeah, and, you know, let's give credit to many Christians. You know, many Christians are horrified by the Calvinistic, by the Calvinist belief system. I mean, not that what they believe is wonderful either, but... Mm-hmm. You
know. Well, this is why so many Christians do not want to know what the Old Testament has to say.
Right.
And so many Christians... I mean, I have personally met a number of Christians who reading the Old Testament is, or former Christians... Reading the Old Testament is what caused them to become former Christians.
Right.
It's just the brutality and the insanity of the abuses described within that text. And again, like you said, the Bible does contain some wisdom in some areas where it's really well written. But
like any book from antiquity of antiquity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, all right. Well, that's going to do it. Everyone, thanks for listening. I earlier recommended that you check this out. I guess I don't recommend that anymore. This website, it's stupid. So we just wasted your time. Well, no, we didn't waste anyone's time. I had fun with this. I always enjoyed going over this kind of stuff and just discussing Christian apologetics and the absurdity of it. Our favorite person, Bob Bryce, is correct in that these guys are snake oil salesmen.
Yeah.
That they're not legitimately concerned with history or truth. Their job is to preserve their faith.
Right.
And,
yeah.
No, and that's all they're trying to do. I mean,
yeah.
What's his name? William Lane Craig. He's not a historian. He's never going to say, you know, I reviewed the history and yeah, the Exodus didn't happen, guys. I'm sorry. I have to admit it. He's not ever going to do that because that's not his job. His job is to downplay the evidence as much as possible to allow Christians to remain Christians. That's right. His job. That's Steve Hayes' job.
Right. They're not interested in truth. They're interested upholding their religious beliefs, and anything that shows evidence of the contrary is to be dismissed. You saw in the Norman Geisler, Mike Lacona situation, and you know.
Well, you know, and there are among the religious populations scientists and historians who do care. I mean, there are Jewish archaeologists and historians who will tell you, yeah, the Exodus never happened. The flood of Noah never happened. We know that. We still believe in God, but we understand that our scriptures aren't inerrant. So you can be, maybe not consistently, but you can be a devoutly religious person and a person who at the same time cares about the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But not if you're an apologist.
Right.
Because that's not your job. Again, like I said, your job is to maintain... the population of the faith is to prevent right. people from leaving the faith, and you will do and say whatever you have to do and say within reason. William Lane Craig's not going to go around massacring atheists and stuff like that, but within reason. I mean, William Lane Craig will say something that he knows is false or probably false. I'm convinced of that. He will use tactics that he knows aren't going to lead people to the truth. But he thinks, in his mind, that a greater good is served.
Right. Yeah. On a positive note, maybe I can share on a future podcast, but, you know, I don't want to bore the details, but I had been participating in a debate with a Christian apologist through email and in person, and, you know what? He got back to me and he said through our discussion, you know, I'm sure the guy's still a fundamentalist, but he said, you know, the last email I heard from him, and we've actually been on friendlier terms since, but he says, you know what? Concerning inerrancy and the Olivet Discourse, which is Jesus' failed apocalyptic prophecies that he was going to return, you know, he said, I've really now thought about stuff I never thought of before. I want to meet. He was just very humble. And, you know, I'm not, I'm sure the guy's going to always be a Christian, but if I at least got him to think and possibly have a somewhat more reasonable and realistic fantasy, yeah. I'd say that's time well spent. And so sometimes, you know, maybe it's not always a waste of time debating these apologists, you know?
Yeah, and if you can, maybe you can lead him to a fantasy that doesn't require him to donate 10% of his income to
right.
local
there
church.
Right, there you go. The good news about this guy is he's on staff at a secular community college mm-hmm. here in the Chicago area. He's not on staff at a Bible college or a theological seminary where if he were to change his views, he would be fired. So he has the freedom in that regard.
He still stands to lose family members and friends.
Yeah.
But at least he'll maintain his income.
Right. Exactly.
And, you know, before we end up, one thing we have learned is, are you familiar with, what is it called? The Clergy Project.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Where, you know, these clergy members from various churches will anonymously admit, man, I'm stuck. I don't believe any of this stuff, but there's no way I could denounce it because I lose everything. And it's amazing, apparently, the number of people that's true of. And I'm sure they only hear from a fraction of those individuals.
Right.
But yeah, this guy, like you said, does have the convenience of not losing his job if he comes to the light. but he can still lose a lot of other stuff, and
sure.
that's unfortunate.
That's not to be minimized, right?
No. So, all right. Well, Mike, thanks. And everybody, thanks for listening. And we'll talk to you later.
Bye.